passages or deliberately study passages that deal with worship, you're reading about something very serious. You're reading about attitude. You're reading about actions. You're determining what it is that we are to do to worship God scripturally and spiritually, in spirit and in truth. But you're also studying a lot. We see a lot of passages that address the attitude of the worshiper. In order for worship to be done properly, you also think in terms even of mechanics of worship. We think in terms of those who lead our worship. This is something that needs to be considered. How seriously do we take that task? Do we understand, and this will convey to others as we demonstrate the attitude and practice it ourselves, do we take it seriously? Do we understand what we're trying to do? If I'm leading in worship, what am I trying to do? Am I trying to help others worship God in spirit and in truth? That should be my objective. You know, it's possible for us to be affected by things that we see in worship. One of the things you see in so-called worship, especially in Catholicism, and sadly too many times in denominationalism, is what we call spectator worship, where really the whole concept is you attend the service and you watch what is done, you know, and you go home and you're not really directly engaged in what is happening. Your mind's not with the people. You think of a Catholic priest and how they pray to God. We don't pray that way. We're not. The prayer leader is not up there leading a prayer as a mediator between church members, listeners, and God, but rather leading the prayer for them. He's a facilitator, a helper. And in all of these areas, we need to think of whether we're talking about mechanics. And by the way, 1 Corinthians 14 does that. 1 Corinthians 14 talks about orderliness in worship. It talks about decency, things done decently and in order. Last verse of that chapter. In an earlier text in 1 Corinthians 14, Paul talks about people talking at the same time. Speakers speaking at the same time. He forbade that. And he said that the people who received messages from the Spirit were to speak in order, one after the other. Others were to listen while one was speaking. But right there earlier than that, I think one verse earlier than that, 1 Corinthians 14:26, he said one of you has a psalm, one of you has a doctrine and interpretation. He mentioned different things they had in the first century church, some of those directly related to the miracle age, but boiled down to leading in worship. So there were leadership positions there. People led in worship. That is, someone led a song or songs. When he said one of you has a song, that can't possibly mean that the one just sang a solo and others spectated. That would violate Ephesians 5 and verse 19, which makes singing reciprocal action taken by two or more people with one another. And the scripture cannot be broken, so how do you harmonize 1 Corinthians 14:26 with Ephesians 5:18? Well, there was a song leader. There were teachers. They were speakers. They were to be listened to, Paul said. And so, engaged in, and on a thinking level, we're to process information and then plan to make the applications of it. So, leadership, it becomes important. We want to learn all of these lessons, but also we need to learn about what worship really is. And I think a good, and I'll never forget years ago, it was a sermon request by Ron Renfro. This has been a long time ago, but I remember he didn't do that very often, but he made a request of failures of worship, corrupt worship in the Old Testament, and I did. I put together a study on that as thorough as I knew how in order to satisfy Ron, because he was quite the Bible student. And so I preached on that years ago. We'll look at a few examples of that in this study, but I want us to study some of the basic concepts and basic principles of worship. What are we trying to do in worship? If worship is to be acceptable to God, it is worship that honors Him. It's interesting, there are a couple of stories in the Old Testament in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 5 with Moses and the burning bush, and God told him to remove his sandals from his feet. Exodus 3:5. Remove your sandals from your feet, because the place where you stand is holy ground. And then the same thing is echoed in Joshua chapter 5 in verse 15, where the angel who was the commander of the Lord's host was interviewing Joshua. And Joshua was told the same thing. Now, what is the idea there? Well, you're attempting to approach God. You're engaging God. And so you need to change your attitude. This may be reflected, for example, in the case with those men, to remove their shoes from their feet. We're nowhere commanded to do that in order to worship God in spirit and in truth today, but they were. And they were commanded that because it had to do with what they were doing. It had to reflect their attitude towards God. We want to remember that true worship honors God and praises God. Failure to do this is devastating. Failure to do it. We were just coming to service this evening. The people out there, you know, getting ready to practice ball out on the rock field, ball field out there. And it's that way about every Sunday evening. Like, isn't that odd? Well, you drove by people coming to the building this evening and doing many other things than thinking about praising God and worshiping God. This happens all of the time. And we sometimes wonder what's happening there in their minds. They don't think about the importance of worshiping God. In Leviticus 10, 1 and 2, you remember that's the passage. It talks about Nadab and Abihu. They got all caught up in the excitement that's talked about at the end of Leviticus chapter 9. And then in chapter 10, they take their censers and they offer, it says, strange fire before the Lord, which he commanded them not. And then fire came out from the Lord and consumed them, executed them. The sons of two of the sons of Aaron. These were Levites. They were priests. And they were killed. They were killed. And why were they killed? Well, the next verse says, God said to Moses and Aaron, I will be sanctified. I will be sanctified in them that come near me, and before all the people, I will be glorified. To me, that's a statement by God that really makes an impression on me. It makes me think, what is my purpose in presuming to worship God, or doing what I might call worshiping God? Well, it's to honor God. God said, I will be. And though he reserves judgment, fire is not coming down out of the sky, consuming people who worship God unscripturally today. If so, then it would just be a lit up day every Sunday. The sky would be full of fire. In about every community and every county and city in every state and across the world. That's what would be happening, because there are so many people so careless when it comes to worship. Their thoughts are not governed by a verse like Leviticus 10 and verse 3, where God said, now those who approach me, who come near to worship me, I will be glorified. Their thoughts are not guided by that. Ours must be. We need to understand the purpose of worship. In Psalm chapter 89 and verse 7, David said, God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints, and to be had in reverence of all them that are about him. Does that sound like the typical worship services of many denominations and mega churches, and particularly mega churches, where worship is a performance, a show? Worship is an event, and you attend that. It may be very exciting. It may be very emotion-packed. Is it focused upon doing what God says do? Too many times, obviously, it is not. Do people fear God in these assemblies? Do they understand that God is to be had in reverence, held in reverence? Well, that's what the Bible teaches. In Hebrews, in the New Testament, Hebrews 12 and verse 28, the Hebrew writer said, wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. So actually, nothing has happened as far as what God expects, how God expects to be approached in worship. Nothing has changed from Psalm 89, the days of David and the law of Moses, to our time, to worshiping God under the new covenant. So attitude is involved in this. In Psalm 84, David said, "My soul longs, yes, faints for the courts of the Lord. My heart," verse 2, "my heart and flesh sing for the joy, for joy to the living God. Blessed are those who dwell in your house, ever singing your praises." Don't you look at verse 10. "For a day in your courts are better than a thousand elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness." What was David's attitude towards worshiping God? David's attitude was that it was something he considered to be a joy. Psalm 122, "I was glad," verse 1, "I was glad when they said, 'Come, let us go up into the house of the Lord.'" That needs to be our attitude. Not a drudgery, not something that we dread, but rather something that we look forward to doing. Why? Why is that? Is it because, well, we get to see our brethren? Well, that's a benefit of worship. We do get to see our brethren, and many of us have busy lives that are in different directions through the week. Many with secular work are tied to that. But it does give us an opportunity to see each other, but that's not my main purpose for being here. It shouldn't be yours either. The main purpose must be to honor God, to serve God. In ado, of course, I want to give the disclaimer here. When I cite Old Testament passages that talk about a sanctuary or the house of God, the temple, Solomon's temple at this time, when we talk about things like that, we are talking about the Old Testament, and we're not trying to compare the church building to the Jewish temple or the nature of worship now under the law of Christ to the nature of worship under the Old Testament, but there is something similar. Our purpose for being here, that is the same. Our purpose should be the same. Our attitude ought to be just like David's. Sadly, history is filled with examples of people not worshiping God acceptably. And you can go through the Bible, and you know, many of you are Bible students, and these will be obvious to you. For example, the situation with Cain back in Genesis chapter 4. Two men, Cain and his brother Abel, were worshiping God. Their purpose was to worship God. Both offered sacrifices. You remember that we're told that Abel's sacrifice was offered by faith. By faith. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 4. Now we know from Romans 10 and verse 17 that faith comes by hearing God's word. So when it says that he acted by faith, then he acted upon God's instructions. He didn't just act upon a good feeling. It wasn't that Abel just had a better feeling than Cain. Feelings dominate worship in much of religion today. And too many times the feelings are substituted for faith, for divine instruction. No, Abel acted by faith. His sacrifice was better, that is, better by virtue of its inward worth. Why is that? That's what the meaning of the Hebrew term there. Because it was a blood sacrifice. God must have told them to do that. God is no respecter of persons. He must have told both Abel and Cain to do it. But Cain didn't do it. He gave of the fruits of the ground. And he failed to worship God by faith. The Bible says Abel is the one who worshiped by faith in Hebrews 11 and verse 4. What about later when the Jews were delivered by divine power involving amazing miracles, spectacular miracles? They were delivered from Egyptian bondage, and then they start their trek, you remember, and they finally get to where their laws... Isn't it amazing to think about what could have happened here? It could have been, had they remained faithful to God, that time was going to be so short. From Egypt, from the release, from the Red Sea crossing, right up to the land of Canaan. But they messed up. messed up in many ways, many areas. You remember later with the spies and all of that and how that factored into this. But they violated God's laws. Many died here on this day. It's talked about in Exodus chapter 32. The people became impatient regarding Moses' absence. He had gone up on Mount Sinai, delayed returning, and they needed to be able to say that here is my God that delivered me from the land of Egypt, from the iron furnace. And so they plead with Aaron to make them gods, and he made them a golden calf. And they worshiped that golden calf. They failed. They failed in their worship. That's idolatry. They simply continue to practice that they had become very familiar with in the land of Egypt, a very idolatrous country. They sinned, and God almost, it seems to imply, in a couple of verses in Exodus 32, destroyed the entire nation of Israel and said, I'll make a new nation. I can make a new nation from you, Moses, which he could have done. But he didn't destroy all of them, but they would be punished for what they did. Think of Jeroboam. You remember the rift between Jeroboam and Rehoboam. You really start to read about this in 1 Kings chapter 12. Rehoboam, the head of what later became known as the house of Israel. Rehoboam, of course, the house of Judah. And in Jerusalem, Jeroboam became very concerned that if the people, that is the people he controlled, were to continue to go to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices and worship, that their hearts would be turned to Rehoboam. So he decided he had some plans. We will change worship. We'll change what we do. We will change the day. We will change the priesthood. He did many things that are not even listed. He set up golden calves at Dan and Bethel and instructed the people, you can go there, whichever is more convenient for you. You can go there and you can worship. You don't have to go to Jerusalem. He made a feast day, a worship day, of the 14th day of the 8th month. If you were to go to Leviticus 23 and read about the feast days of the Jews, you would read about the Passover day on the 14th day of the 1st month. You would read about the Day of Atonement on the 10th day of the 7th month. You would read about how you calculate the observance of the Day of Pentecost, which was based upon harvest time. You know, all of that, but you did not read about anything on the 15th day of the 8th month. 15th day, and that's what Jeroboam set up. He set up priests from people not of the tribe of Levi, and of the lower class, it says, of people. So in other words, no scruples, no morals. He made these the religious leaders. All types of changes that happen, that was held against the Jewish people for decades after that. And it damaged them for all of those years as well. Manasseh, think of how extreme he was. He built altars to Baal and Asherah to cover the main deities of the land before the Jews came in. In the temple he did this. He offered his sons to the god Molech. Remember the bull with the outstretched arms, and they would lay their little children on these arms of this thing, burn a fire inside of its belly, and bake them, roast them, execute them, offer them in sacrifice to Molech. He used mediums and wizards, we're told in 2 Chronicles 33, all explicitly condemned in the law of Moses, and corrupted worship. The Jews, as Isaac read a few minutes ago, drifted into a practice of offering their blind animals as sacrifices, their lame ones, their sick ones. All those things are mentioned there in Malachi chapter 1, and they were condemned for that. They defiled, Malachi said, the Lord's table. Today we have some new ideas with regard to worship that are dangerous. One of them is this idea that all of life is worship. I'm going to explain to you here in a little bit why this position is hell. Why people want to believe this. But first let me show you what passage is cited and how it is misused in order to justify this idea that all of life is worship. The reason I see this as so dangerous is because it convinces people that they do not have to attend a worship assembly. They don't need to attend a church service. In fact, they don't really even need a church. The New Testament is built upon the concept of the church, the universal and local churches. Think of how much the New Testament, how much of the New Testament is written about local churches. I know people want to believe that local churches are not important, or local church membership is not important, but that's the bulk of New Testament epistles. Is to churches, local churches, and about local churches. You get to the book of Revelation. Here you have the big book, but there were certain little letters in the big book of Revelation that were sent to the respective seven churches of Asia. So what is the basis of it? The seven churches of Asia. But these merely represented local churches. They represented local churches. And so even the book of Revelation is based upon the importance of the local church. But people cite Romans chapter 12 and verse 1. Paul said, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. But then the New American Standard Bible, and maybe some others, say of worship. They include the word worship there. The word worship doesn't belong in this verse. The word latruo is the word that is used here, is the word that means service. Service is a better translation of this word. We know this because of other passages that do this. For example, in John 17 and verse 2, notice that Jesus is speaking and he's warning the disciples of the troubles ahead. And he said, one of the things you're going to encounter is people, the Jews, putting you out of their synagogues. Putting you out of their synagogues. Yes, the time will come. Notice how far this will go. The time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers God a service. This is the word in Romans 12 and verse 1. And here it is translated service, doing God a service. It's not intended to be translated worship here, obviously, but that one is doing a service to God by killing Christians. Jesus was warning the disciples about that. The Greek words are the same. And over in Matthew 4 and verse 10, this is almost an inspired commentary by no less than the Son of the living God, Jesus Christ. In Matthew chapter 4 and verse 10, when Jesus answered Satan, said, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God. That's not our word. It's a different word. And him only shall you serve. That is our word, latruo, latruo. And so you see it there. And in Romans chapter 1 and verse 25, they worshipped and served the creature more than the creator. What about the word serve there? Well, it's the word in Romans 12 and verse 1, latruo. So Romans 12, 1 doesn't teach what people want it to teach. I'm going to explain to you later why they want it to teach that. But it doesn't teach it. It doesn't teach that all of life, everything we do in life, is worship. The King James, the old King James, uses the expression reasonable service. I always thought it was interesting. The Greek word for reasonable here is the Greek word from which we get our word logic. So it's a logical thing when you think about it. It's logical, reasonable service. Or the New King James, which is your reasonable service. Or ASV, which is your spiritual service. Your spiritual service. But I want you to notice that the Bible teaches that not all of life is worship. We talked a lot about Abraham recently in our Romans study and his faith being the model. God said, Abraham, and Abraham's faith is the model of salvation. The model of how you are justified. Abraham. Well, what if we examined the life of Abraham and looked at worship. Did Abraham think that no matter what he was doing, no matter where he was always in the act of worshiping God? He didn't believe that. He didn't believe that. Genesis chapter 22 and verse 5 talks about Abraham telling his servants to explain to them what he was doing, taking Isaac with him somewhere. He said, "We are going yonder to worship and we'll come back to you. We're going to go to a place, we're going to worship, then we're going to stop worshiping and we'll come back to you." That's the implication here. So not all of life. The trip on the donkey to the top of the mountain was not worship. Worship would be what he did when they got there. So Abraham is an example on this in Genesis 22 and verse 5. In Exodus chapter 24 and verse 1, God told Moses, "Come up to the Lord and worship from afar." Well, what couldn't he worship near? Why couldn't he just worship where he was? Because God designed worship differently than what humans think of. David is just a classic example of this. In 2 Samuel 12, after the incident with Bathsheba, her subsequent pregnancy, then loss of child. She loses the child. You remember the story about David and his grieving there and the servants being concerned about David. And then the word that the child had died. And what did David do? He shaved himself, he changed his clothes, and he went and worshipped. Was he not already worshiping during his grieving? In his previous circumstance? In his dirty clothes? Was that not already worship? No, it was not. He would go into the house of the Lord and worship. And notice that a lot of times you see in these passages a beginning and then a stopping point of the worship. Somebody might say, "Yeah, we go to worship, and then you know we leave, and we're just still worshiping God, even when we go eat our lunch after services, and maybe we go play some ball, we do whatever hobby maybe we have on Sunday afternoon, or do some work on Sunday afternoon. We're not under the law of Moses." And so we might do a little work on Sunday afternoon. And we're just worshiping God away. No. No, this says that then he went to his own house. There's a break. He went and worshiped. Then he's not worshiping anymore. Not all of life is worship. But again, you might be thinking, "Well, you seem like you're beating a dead horse." No. There are a lot of people who want to believe this. I have argued this with people through the years. I remember arguing this when I was at Florida College, arguing against this. Because there are a lot of people that believe this. It's sort of the emotion of the concept, I think, that attracts people to it. That all of life is... Well, some are misled by the misuse of Romans 12:1. Matthew chapter 2. What did the wise men do? The wise men came to Bethlehem to do what? To worship Jesus. Well, why did they have to travel all the way to Bethlehem to do that? They came to a place of worship where the person of Jesus was. When they found him, they fell at his feet and worshiped him. It's just like that all of the time. In all of the examples in the New Testament of Jesus being worshiped, I'm not going to go through and read all of these verses here, cite them all to you. There's several times where it says, "And they worshiped him." Matthew 8:2, Matthew 9:18, 14:30-15:25, after the feedings of the 4,000, feedings of the 5,000, and feeding of the 4,000. In Matthew chapter 28, the story there of the women and the reports about the risen Christ, and it says, "And they worshiped him." And the blind man in John chapter 9 in verse 38, we talked about him this morning. Another connection. He worshiped Jesus. And then they did something else. In the Luke account of this, in Luke 24 and verse 52, it says they worshiped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. They worshiped him, then they stopped worshiping him and went back to Jerusalem with great joy. Not all of life is worship. It has a beginning point and it has an ending point. It also has a when and a where. In John chapter 12 and verse 20, it says, "Now there were certain Greeks among those who came to worship at the feast." I'd like to point out in 1 Corinthians 11. 1 Corinthians 11 talks about the Lord's Supper. It talks about coming together. Remember, I talked a lot about that during the old COVID religious crisis. It talks about brethren coming together to eat the Lord's Supper. Acts 20. Isn't it amazing how many times a verse can be used by brethren and they just all of a sudden completely forget that it's in the Bible? That happened during COVID. Acts 20 and 7, everybody knew about Acts chapter 20 and verse 7. All of a sudden, what difference? What does that matter? Did we not read that and quote that and talk about that for years? We use that as a go-to passage to establish authority for a weekly observance of the Lord's Supper. Now, all of a sudden, what? Well, that must not be what that meant. That must not be important. It's amazing. You can have a verse used over and over and over, and all of a sudden, brethren, just too many brethren, can just play like it doesn't exist. No, and so I point out in 1 Corinthians 11, when it says they came together, what does that necessitate? How are you going to come together? There's going to have to be some planning for this. We need a time when we can get together, right? Okay, so we set a time of 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. All right, that ought to do it. Nope, that won't do it. You can't just set a time at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. We're going to have to also set a place. Now we have a time and a place, then we can meet together. Otherwise, you can't meet together. If people are at different times or at different places, they cannot be together. They're not together. So this is implied in these passages that talk about church assemblies, a time and a place. So it says, there were certain Greeks among those who came to worship at the feast. The Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8 had been to Jerusalem to worship. Had been to Jerusalem to worship. And then he was returning. He's not now worshiping. He's riding in a chariot going back home. So we could use the Old Testament on this, or we can use the New Testament. Paul even referenced in his speech in Acts chapter 24 what he had done, because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship. Paul, I thought we were just worshiping all the time. No, I went to Jerusalem to worship. But you're worshiping. No, I'm not worshiping all the time is the point. I went to Jerusalem to worship. And I'm looking at the clock here and I need to quit. But let me, on this piece of this sermon, let me make a couple of points about why this is done. This is done because of the sort of the movement of informality. That's what people don't want to think in terms of a set time of structured worship, of people sitting, you know, by each other and focused upon what they're doing. Some people like this idea, sort of a wild party-like atmosphere during worship. They completely disregard 1 Corinthians 14:40, let all things be done decently and in order. And they want this because it has to have the word here, spontaneous, impromptu. That's what they want, and so that's why they need this to be restructured. They need all of life to be worshiped. But Paul taught very clearly, and he taught this in all of the churches, 1 Corinthians 14:17 is where he says that, and in chapter 14 and verse 33, God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. What was their common practice? Well, that things, if you read then the rest of those verses, we don't have time to do tonight, be done decently and in order. People are not all talking at the same time. People are not all preaching lessons at the same time. He describes that. He corrects many misconceptions they may have had about that. Seems like the Corinthians thought if the Spirit put a message in your mind, this was the miracle age, put a message in your head that, you know, boy, I got to speak that right now. I said, no. Spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. You can retain the message, then speak it later in order after the other speaker has finished. And then he closes that by saying, let all things be done decently and in order. It seemed like I had... Yeah. The modern concept is the old pep rally church service. Pep rally worship service. And that is not about God, by the way. That is not some... This is not like Isaiah, the person in Isaiah 66 in verse 2. God said, this is who I want. I want one who is of a humble and contrite spirit who trembles at my word. This is not that person. The pep rally worshiper is all about himself. He's about me. Worship is then about me. Worship is about how... I'm sorry to say, the mindset of too many people. Worship should not be about me. Worship should be about my purpose in honoring God. Now, what all goes into that? We haven't gotten to that part yet. We'll need to look at that. And things that can be done to facilitate in that, I want to talk about a little bit more. But it's important that we understand what worship is. There could be someone here this evening who isn't a Christian. We ought to think also in terms of putting ourselves in a position of being able to worship God in spirit and in truth. And that is reserved for God's children. We need to be in fellowship with God. The way we do that, of course, is meet the conditions of salvation. In each case, and what we're doing is we've been studying the book of Romans. Our trust is in God in each case. Our reliance is upon God when we believe, when we repent. When we acknowledge Jesus as the Son of God, when we are baptized, all of these are just acts of reliance upon God's mercy. So I have to remember that part. Nonetheless, we have our duty. We still have to do what Peter told people to do in Acts chapter 2 and verse 40. Work out your own salvation. Save yourselves from this. Paul did in Philippians 2:12, and then Peter did in Acts chapter 2 and verse 40. Save yourselves from this untoward generation. So I have something to do. If tonight you want to meet those conditions, put yourself in a position to be able to please God, to honor God in worship of God. We want to help you do that. If you need to do so tonight, come forward as we stand and sing to encourage you.
Our son.